88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm your host, Taylor. I want to start the show with a shout out to Jason Cross for producing that brand new theme music for me. We get to start 2019 with brand new music, so get used to hearing that. So thanks again, Jason. And if you are just tuning in, congratulations, you caught the very beginning of the show. I am going to share an interview with you today that I recorded yesterday in the studio after going out for First Friday here in Spokane and catching a visual art show that I really enjoyed by Richard Smolinski. If you get a chance to see it, it's up all month at the Terrain Gallery and had a lot of political content, a lot of really interesting content around kind of what's going on both in this country and across different countries all around the world. With our politics, with our discourse, ideas around masculinity, all kinds of stuff. So we ended up having a long, great conversation about that. And without too much fuss, I'm just going to get that going for you. So thanks for listening. I'll pop in a few times on the interview and let you know how you can find out more and all the rest. So enjoy this interview, like I said, from yesterday with Richard Smolinski. So I am here recording in the studio yesterday, if you're listening today, with Richard Smolinski. He is an artist who has a show up in Spokane through this month at the Terrain Gallery. I saw it on Friday. I really liked the work, and I thought we could come and talk about it in the studio today. So hi.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Yeah. It's a great town. I've been really enjoying my time here.
Good. You're here just long enough to,
oh.
to not have it wear off. So I don't know if you want to start by just introducing yourself, talking a little bit about who you are and your practice.
Certainly. I'm currently living and working in Toronto. Worked there for the last 3 years now. And before that, I was in Western Canada, mostly in Calgary for, I think, 16 years. So quite a long time there. Throughout my career, I've been very interested in politically critical work, socially critical work maybe is also another way to think about it, and especially with the work that's in the Terrain Gallery right now. It's a work that's been informed by my long-term interest in kind of socially critical figuration, where I kind of look at kind of human interrelationships. And this work that I'm presenting right now features a lot of my interest in kind of male behavior and kind of male group dynamics. So I think that's a big part of what I've been working my way through and trying to understand through my art over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a big part of when I read the artist statement and then saw the work and then talked with you, I was like, yes, a man I can talk about toxic masculinity with on the air, because I found that as a woman complaining about it, sometimes it doesn't go over great with the male audience.
I think
you're the person who should speak to it.
I think this is what I'm starting to realize, is that I think it was implicit in my work for a number of years, and then I think I started to learn that as a term, and I went, oh yes, that is the way I have to describe this, because I think it has a lot of resonance, and I think it kind of cuts across and makes a bridge towards, you know, from the male perspective to other perspectives. And I think who better to start to address these issues than somebody who's part of that identity and needs to kind of help my fellow men start to account for the way we behave. So yeah. I think that's why I've been very interested in that term, and the last couple of years been trying to learn as much as I can about what it means and why it's important to use that term as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. So just to back up a little bit to the show that's up, can you just talk about it a little bit, like how, like the origin and kind of the form for people who haven't seen it?
I'll try. It's complicated because there's a few different ways that it works in my mind. Part of it is based on language, and I use a lot of word coinage games and playing with language to try to devise new ways of describing things. In a lot of ways, I try to pick very common language with this idea that by blending it together, it kind of yields these new terms. Like, for instance, the exhibition is called scrutineer-sighted, and that's a term I devised when I was started to focus on this part of this project about 2.5 years ago, when I started to get very concerned about a number of elections that were happening in the world. I have to say, I spent a lot of time thinking about the run-up to the last presidential election and even the how the different candidates were being selected, and I was kind of shocked and appalled at the ways that political discourse was happening in the U.S. But also was really interested in the Brexit, or what became Brexit in the U.K., how this Prime Minister Cameron kind of gets pushed into having this referendum, and before he knows it, it gets out of hand, and not only does the referendum go through to leave the European Union, but of course Cameron then is in a position where he has to kind of resign. So it's because a lot of these political choices that are made, I don't think we even understand all the repercussions of them all the time. So that's why scrutineers cited is something I developed for the title, because in a lot of ways, scrutineers are part of the election process. And I think I don't know if the term's used as much in the U.S., but in Canada, scrutineers are appointed by each party to oversee and ensure that the election is done fairly. So it's kind of like everyone has their kind of person that watches to make sure that voting is done properly and spending is done properly. But one of the things with that is that, because you're scrutineering and you're representing that one party, you maybe have a bit of a very narrow focus and kind of maybe a biased opinion. So in a lot of ways, that's the nearsighted part of the title of the show, is that every time we have a particular political perspective, we might find that that limits the way we think about things. So I think that's kind of what parts of the things I started to try and incorporate into the work is different perspectives. There's great changes of scale. So everything seems to be at times in the imagery in that show very much about creating a unstable and kind of very unpredictable environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the form is kind of, it's like, I don't know if you would describe it as a mural. It's borderline mural, because it's all of these interconnected paintings that are kind of telling a story together, flowing into one another.
I do describe it as a kind of a either a piecemeal mural or kind of a mosaic mural. Mm-hmm. Have described it as kind of a disintegrating tableau. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with the kind of tableau, the long kind of panoramic sort of imagery. So I think one of the things with that is, rather than having one image that has everything incorporated into it, the format of the exhibition with this mural or mosaic sort of effect tableau is that one image kind of leads more naturally into another, so you're never even feeling like you're entirely having closure with one image before you start to get distracted with the next, which is kind of how I feel about politics in the world. Is there's things I think I was so concerned about that 4 months ago, and I haven't thought about it because now there's been all these new things have happened, and I keep on getting distracted by new issues that come up, which are really important, but it's all really very difficult to understand and start to incorporate into the way you think about things.
Yeah. Last week we did a year in review show. Guest host tonight, and it was nearly impossible because it was January. Like, that feels like it was 5 years ago.
Yep.
Because we have this speed. And you say in the artist statement that there aren't any direct depictions of any characters. However, there's definitely some kind of aggregates. There's some archetypes that show up. I think it's almost entirely male, like.
Oh yeah, almost figures. Almost every figure in the exhibition is male.
There's some vaguely religiously affiliated looking folks. There's some men with microphones who I'm sure we can use our imagination and think about who they might be metaphorically or literally. There's political figures.
Well, I think, for instance, I was very interested in the kind of industry of the punditry, where there's this kind of subsector or kind of a professional class, which their function really is just to comment on current affairs. And I thought, what a strange yet interesting how did this profession develop? And it must, really, I would think that it's a fairly recent phenomenon, but perhaps it's really just kind of a continuation of something that's been long established over time. So there's things like when you were saying about the microphones, that was one of the things that when I first started the this part of the this latest series was that a lot of it was not just about the incidents that were happening, but also the way that the incidents were being presented and kind of mediated by things like pundits and, well, the media, for instance. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I guess the other part, and you alluded to it earlier and talked about it, is the use of language in the work, because there's a lot of, I guess, poetic or indirect language kind of labeling and captioning some of the work. And a lot of them are portmanteau, so like words combined into new words and like semi-nonsense, but also not nonsense. I think my favorite that I have a picture of is Knuckle Draggergit.
That's a good one. I'm glad somebody likes that one. Yeah. That one's even, you know, I sometimes when I'm developing these things, one of my rules used to be that if I couldn't say it, I shouldn't use it, sort of thing. So I actually had to teach myself how to say knuckle drag. See, I can't
drag rigget.
Yeah, I'm out of practice now.
That, that gurgur sound.
Oh, know? It's a tough one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's, you know, I think that's one of those things that I, you know, when I'm kind of thinking about things, I think about, you know, often kind of stereotypical ways that things are described, and the kind of idea of knuckle dragging, I've often have this picture of, I know who those people are, and I've had to deal with people that it kind of, when I hear the phrase knuckle dragger, I know the people, I've dealt with those people. So I think that's why I wanted to kind of incorporate that in, because for instance, in the kind of toxic masculinity, that is one of the kind of, I would say was kind of one of the most extreme classes of men that you know, do kind of create the toxic environment between the different identities. So knuckle draggers are, I don't know if I'd say have a special place in my heart, or maybe a special part of my concern. Maybe that's the best way to say it.
Yeah, they're special focus that you're
special focus, that's
aware right. of. Yeah. So what inspired, because you use language in that way in some of your other work too, right?
Yes.
So like what's your...
I think I always, well, in my weird career trajectory, after I realized I wasn't going to be a diplomat, I started to kind of think I was going to be a writer, but I don't really have a very methodical way of writing or thinking about kind of how stories work. But I still liked kind of the playing with language and liked, you know, the difference between what something looked like on the page and what something might sound like. And I think with something like the portmanteau, I liked it because it was usually used very simple words, but those simple words could have really interesting connotations when they're kind of put in these unlikely combinations. So with that as a thing I was aware of, I started to kind of, when I was doing my PhD, started to kind of want to develop different ways of working. I'd worked as a visual artist, a lot of figurative work for many years and very kind of social commentary type work. But I started to get more interested in performance, and I tried to figure out ways of describing the sort of performance works I wanted to do. And this is where I went back to the portmanteaus and started to use those to invent terminology to describe these works I was doing, and that really helped. So, for instance, during the exhibition, the performance I did is what I would call a coin agitation, where it's kind of coinage and agitation, where I'm trying to kind of promote the idea that people can intervene into language and take ownership of language and start to use it creatively. Because really, one of our problems is that I think part of our imagination is kind of tightly restricted by how we define things, and, you know, often language defines us as opposed to we defining what language can be and what mm-hmm. possibilities might exist. So that performance was my attempt to kind of introduce people that we can take some kind of control over language and start to use it creatively to kind of create a different world, as opposed to being always kind of restricted to what we're accustomed to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's such a, I feel like that's a high level disagreement and like struggle that's happening politically, kind of on the top of everything else. There's this idea that this, like, the Enlightenment was the peak of human achievement and that we're not allowed to change. And there is, it's kind of a generational struggle, but it's also just a power struggle about that, about like, well, words have these specific meanings and these kids are making up all these new genders and all these new words, you know, like that. That's an idea that I hear expressed a lot. In some ways it is very inherently political to just say, I made up a word and this is what it means.
Yeah.
And you can do it too.
And yeah. And I think that's kind of one of the hopes is like, it's kind of funny when you mention about the kind of gender, you know, creating these new gender identities as opposed to the idea that those gender identities always existed. But in many times we're kind of written out of history and social practice because there was this idea of kind of heteronormality or normalcy kind of dominating the way we would think about the relationship between different people. And now it's just this, we're now starting to have opportunities where people are taking kind of control and determining that this is who they are and this is what their personal integrity is, and starting to assert that on the world as opposed to being just marginalized and silenced. So I think that's kind of where my agitation part of coinage, I think, starts to be something that I hope by doing these things is that it gives people an opportunity or reminds people that this is possible.
Yeah. Because, like you said, we've always known.
We hope, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny when you kind of talk about the Enlightenment, because I often think about that, this kind of fake peak that we're supposed to have, and it's been all downhill since then, as opposed to, wow, that peak of society or that peak of human development led us directly to colonization and strip mining the world. Boy, yeah. That's the great result that was. Maybe I kind of think that maybe we're actually going towards a better time because we are starting to kind of deal with those very poor and terrible decisions that we made in the past and hopefully start to have more inclusive societies that do find places for the greatest variety of identities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking with artist and satirist. I don't know how you.
Sure.
and, you know, agitator, coin agitator.
I'll take that.
Richard Smolinski, who has a show right now at the Terrain Gallery through the end of January. I will post links to that in the podcast and everything. I was looking on your website, and you did a research project about just what we were discussing around gender, omnivore sexual.
Oh,
is
yes.
That, am I saying that correctly? There's so much pronunciation.
I know that omnivore sexual. Yeah, that's the way I was saying it when it.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what that was?
Yeah, that was a really interesting project. It was part of a conference on Magnus Hirschfeld, who had a very influential and important Institute for sexual science in Germany just before World War II, and he was doing a lot of research into the kind of variety of human experience around sexuality and gender identity, and unfortunately, he was doing all this kind of cutting-edge research. He actually developed some really very nuanced language about different sort of definitions about what different genders might be and different kind of sexual preferences and also kind of just what we would call fetishes today. I think he was kind of interested in those as kind of very unique and individualized special interests, which is kind of a very kind of positive way of thinking about something that often has kind of a real negative connotation in our contemporary world. But unfortunately, the Nazis eventually started to question the validity of his research and shut down his institution. And really, most of his research that wasn't published just disappeared. So that was a very kind of tragic thing in terms of this cutting edge research. So this conference was being held at the University of Calgary. The organizers were some faculty that were at the University of Calgary at that time, and this exhibition was a complementary to that, and it was called Pop Sex, and this idea was kind of a short, snappy version of popular sex, and my contribution to it was a number of disabled filing cabinets that kind of formed something that looked like the Berlin Wall, but you couldn't open the filing cabinets. They were kind of pushed together so that they were no longer functioning like that. And then on one side, there was a continuous surface where I had all these magnets of different sexual identities and gender identities I just invented, because I kind of thought that, you know, here's all these research that Hirschfeld had created, but that's been lost. And this was my kind of imagining what some of that might have been, and just saying, here's all these terms that could be possible ways that people could think about who they are as kind of sexual beings, or as kind of different gender identities. So this is where these different magnets kind of had this kind of flow chart sort of effect, with little arrows and things kind of connecting or showing that this sort of personality might be attracted to this sort of personality, but not that that personality. But because they were magnets, people could actually move them around and kind of reshuffle them. So that was kind of a fun sort of, you know, kind of hopefully kind of participatory thing, where people could realize that the relationships between different identities could be shifting, and they could actually kind of imagine how they could be revised and kind of changed. So once again, this kind of idea that we don't have to be kind of in this position where things are static and, you know, this our reality is unchangeable. Here we can kind of start to imagine that things can be altered. So that exhibition, I think, had 8 or 9 different artists that were invited to develop projects specifically for that exhibition, which was quite a fun and interesting sort of project to be part of. So
nice. And so we opened
So omnivore sexual was this this idea of, you know, rather than being kind of one sort of thing, you know, the big title was I was hopefully trying to kind of capture something that suggested that there was this kind of panoply?
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's the word. I just invented it if it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this kind of variety of identities all kind of sharing this kind of space together. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, you're fine. Please do. We opened up the hour talking about masculinity and toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the other side of that spectrum of panoply, if that's the word we're trying to use.
Yes, that's probably a good way to think about it.
Yeah, it's kind of this idea that there's one thing that is being a man and that you must do it.
It's very coercive, too.
I guess I'm wondering, without getting too, like, I don't want you to feel like you're on the therapist couch, but I'm curious about, like, your own journey in navigating masculinity. That's not something that I've been coerced into doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of curious about how you got to the analysis that you have now around that.
Or
why it's important to you.
Ooh, why it's, I guess the why it's important is maybe a bit easier to how I ended up here. As I try to learn about the world, and, you know, not just through the media, because that's just one way, but maybe talk about that as the first thing. But even in my little bit of time that I spend watching news broadcasts and looking at news feeds and then reading things online, I'm amazed often at how power is misapplied and most often misapplied by men, and with this implicit, if not always explicit, sort of idea that it's a man's right to have power, B, and it's a man's right to behave as they want to without any sort of real care of the repercussions. You know, the idea of I have the right to do this it seems to be always above the sort of sense of responsibility, or what's the outcome. You know, what sort of responsibilities do you have to those people that might be affected by one's actions and behaviors? And even just in the newspaper I was reading earlier today, one of the free newspapers, I was looking around and I was reading about this incident that happened in Idaho, and it's funny because I think the name jumped out at me because it was Richard Sovensky, and I went, oh my God, and then I thought, oh my God, it's me. But it was this racially motivated hate crime, mm-hmm. that he was had been accused of, but apparently has been found not guilty. And I was just like reading about the story and is going, my God, this sounds terrible.
Mm-hmm. And it's all on camera.
And how did people not think that this was something that was that he was guilty for, because it's so obvious. It seemed very obvious that even the little bit I was familiar with it, that what a terrible thing, and you know, how was he not found guilty? But I think this is one of these things where I think there's this aggregate of power and practice that's been so strongly put into place that, you know, the freedom of speech in this case seems to, you know, you can be as hateful as you want because you have the right to be hateful, as opposed to one should kind of be a civil member of society because we have responsibility to each other. So I think this is maybe why I find it really important. And it's almost maybe because I find it inescapable for me to not kind of think about these things and kind of make that sort of associations between abuse of power and male behavior. And for whatever reason, throughout my life, I've kind of like went, you know, when in doubt, follow the man. Yeah, or I would say another, you know, I would say a part of the anatomy. Mm-hmm. But
we're on the radio.
I think we can all kind of fill in the blanks there.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I guess your show, looking at the imagery and the way it all connects, talking about toxic masculinity, sometimes it seems very like literal. Like there's a lot of ooze happening in the imagery. Like I feel like there's like leaking.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Bins are kind of like this oil situation. There's just sludge throughout.
The sludge is just all over, and it's just like,
and it's just sticking to everything. And it's a little, you know, it's a little bleak, like the collected, like walking through the whole thing. I could have spent hours, you know, I didn't, because there's so much detail in the work, but it ends up kind of bleak. So I guess I'm wondering, like, has doing this work and like living in the world that we live in given you a bleak outlook, or are you more hopeful at the end of the day?
I think it's funny. I think not that it's therapeutic to do the work. I think it is helpful to do the work, because I think it really takes all the unarticulated concern and pain and frustration I might find or feel as I'm kind of thinking about what's happening in the world. And I think at least it transforms it into something else, which I can say, this is how I understand this problem. And then because I've spent time kind of articulating it and analyzing it and transforming the problem, it does allow me to kind of have a fresh perspective when I do see that there's not all things in the world are bad male behavior. There is lots of other things that are very positive, and I feel very lucky that there's things like in my world, my work as an educator, I feel like I've had this great privilege to work with these wonderful people that are just starting to pursue their interest in kind of creative culture. So, you know, there's things like that where, as much as most of my work deals with these very dark things that are not happy at all, I do have these other things that I can recognize as being so important. I'm so lucky to have those things being part of my life. So I think the bleakness is me acknowledging that it exists in the world and trying my best to kind of do something about it, even though it's maybe not creating kind of substantial change in any sort of way, but I hope in some sort of way that I contribute to the incremental change and perspective, and people maybe realizing that things do not have to be what they seem, how they seem like they are right now, and there can be different and new ways of creatively responding to the world, and maybe doing something that is positive with one's experience of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess as an educator and as an artist, do you think that creative expression, do you think that art is the best way to climb out of the sludge and to help pull each other out of
no the sludge? I think many people it is really helpful, and I think creativity is really useful, but some of the people that I think do really important work in the world, I think are very creative because they bring a certain creativity, how they problem solve, and they think, you know, I want to help this particular community in this sort of way, and I want to create this service for them, and they figure out ways of creatively networking and finding the right stakeholders that want to be part of this vision to do this positive thing. And it's kind of as creative as any art I've seen, mm-hmm. even though nobody would really kind of think of it as art, but it's really kind of, this really can be a very important and amazing sort of social practice where you kind of create this possibility where none existed in the before that, just because a person has a particular vision and passion to do something that is worthwhile.
Yeah.
So I think creativity in that sort of way, there's all sorts of versions of creativity. And one of the things with the performance thing with the coin agitation, when I'm trying to kind of think about how I'm interested in inviting people to practice their creativity, I think it's because I think it can be successful because I think everyone has some creativity, but we just don't often feel that we have the opportunity to express it, or the opportunity to practice it, or we even know how to always kind of tap into our creative resources. So I think this is one of those ways that the performance can be a kind of like a little spark or a little prod to getting people to kind of think differently and behave differently, with the hope that that kind of creative experience can maybe spark their creative thinking in other aspects of their life, even though they might not consciously be thinking about, oh, now I've had this creative experience, I'm going to be an artist. But they might kind of go, I've had this creative experience, and now I want to do this different thing that has a very positive and meaningful impact on their lives, and maybe on the impacts the lives of others really positively as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And well, I guess I should pop in again. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking with Richard Smolinski. He's an artist who has been visiting us from Toronto here in Spokane this last weekend, had an opening on Friday, and his show will continue to be up at the Terrain Gallery all month. So you can look at the podcast notes for all of that, and you can find that at kyrs.org under my show page, Praxis. So I guess speaking of Praxis, since this is generally a show, I like to talk to artists when I can, because I think that, like you were just explaining, creativity is such a part of making social change, and it's a fundamentally creative act, and the artists are always there inspiring the movements, and we have all the music from all these social movements and so on. What do you think just about, I guess, the moment that we're in right now, obviously a rather dire one, about protests, like the culture of protests that we're in right now, making change, the performance of all of that? That's not much of a question.
Oh,
but, you know.
Yeah, well, I find I certainly would be not one that would discourage people from protesting. And protesting, I think, has a very important function because, especially, I think there's one thing to feel that you have something that you care very deeply about, but to kind of show it and try to put it into practice, I think, is really important. One thing that I think people sometimes overlook is the, you know, with protest and kind of letting their opinions be known, is that I do think that that changes things over time, even though there's always this, there's never easy to determine sort of link between that action and some future outcome. I do think that there's been a lot of change that happens, and we can't even pull back or go through and unweave what happened between the first action and the outcome. But I do think things like protest are important. But I think protest is really, in many ways, just the beginning of engagement, as opposed to the end-all, be-all of you know, a social concern, is starting to kind of figure out, is there ways I can do something else that's worthwhile, and is there how do I kind of take the next step to have kind of positive social change and things that you want to make sure that you're actively participating in. I think this is the thing, is that sometimes I think maybe the current concern is that kind of passive participation, you know, the idea that there's maybe kind of a too much participation is assumed to be things like the, drawing a blank here, what do you call it? The hashtag problem. You know, I think too many people assume that so much protest is done in this kind of electronic format that we forget that a lot of protest continues to be done in more embodied and kind of efficacious sort of ways, as opposed to just kind of that sort of format. So I think that's, how do I put this? I think protest has been maybe unduly questioned because of this more this kind of right now current sort of manifestation of that particular type of protest. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of, you know, we're being distracted by that as a thing, as opposed to that's just one part of the kind of protest and social engagement, as opposed mm-hmm. to just protest, because maybe that's protest sounds just merely negative, as opposed to it's part of the range of social engagement that mm-hmm. people can currently be part of.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot as someone who's been an activist for a long time, and people's image of what when you say you're an activist, which I don't even say at this point, because it's just because it's this dead end of people thinking that you're like that person who yells with a sign on the street corner.
Yep.
And that's such a small portion. And because of our kind of instant gratification culture and our news cycle, that's just like bam, 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 four stories a day that you're supposed to be invested in emotionally. I think that I've experienced since the Trump election in the U.S. a lot of new people who are suddenly like, oh, crap, my country's in trouble. I'm going to come to this protest, and that's going to be the thing I have to do.
And then after the going to the protest, the next thing I need to do is...
Exactly, yeah. And it's created this really rapid cycle of disillusionment.
Oh, and that's probably one of the biggest problems, is that because we don't maybe always see how the kind of protest process as being kind of several steps, is that disillusionment can happen more quickly because you don't feel that there's that feeling of direct accomplishment. We didn't really accomplish what we set out to do with this protest. Well, you know, give it time. It's part of the mm-hmm. the way that this you have the catalytic moment, and then, you know, the kind of ferment, and then hopefully over time it kind of grows until positive resolution can actually happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in your statement for the show that's up now, Scrutineer-sided. I said it right.
Very good.
A raised fist to that. You explicitly reference Me Too, which, and you were just talking about hashtags. And that's kind of an example, I feel like, where that hashtag actually started quite some time ago, you mm-hmm. know, years ago, and then went dormant and then came back. And, you know, now is a movement with teeth, and it's something that everyone knows about. What drove your inclusion of that?
You know, I was starting to kind of, I think I really want to kind of remind myself of why that was important when I first became aware of it, because I thought, here's a good example of it, this isn't a social problem that just had its kind of fad. It is something that what Me Too and the kind of revelations of these assault scenarios that women were suffering through is that hasn't gone away. That continues to happen, and unfortunately will probably continue to happen into the future. And it seemed that in the kind of news cycle sort of ethos that we're in, is that all of a sudden it's disappeared for a while because, you know, people got just used to that. Oh, here's another person who's being accused of this, and oh, it's just another day in, you know, mm-hmm. our contemporary world. Oh, mm-hmm. isn't that quaint? And oh, that little movement that, oh, right, what was that, Me Something? And mm-hmm. yeah, oh, that was so interesting when that was happening. But that is a good example of that social situation and social reality hasn't disappeared. It continues to be relevant. And I'm still shocked at how many times, you know, going through the media, a new person is kind of being pointed, you know, it's become in the public spotlight because of their actions and what they did to other people and the way they kind of impacted other people's lives and careers through their actions. So whichever different celebrity or political figure is responsible, or religious figure that's been responsible for these things, it's amazing how much it does seem like it's a kind of an epidemic that refuses to just go away or be easily silenced. So mm-hmm. I think this is one of the reasons I thought it was important for me to kind of mention that, because I have no problem imagining that even though we might not continue to hear about Me Too in the next 6 months or the next year, there's going to be still plenty of incidents that go unreported that are kind of unfortunately still part of that kind of social reality of that environment of kind of sexualized power brokering and mm-hmm. kind of sexualized poor treatment of another person. That just is kind of, once again, I think knowing enough of my fellow men. It's not like it's, I can imagine it going to be very kind of quick to be resolved, unfortunately.
Yeah. But at least, you know, it's in motion now. Like, it's in play.
So. Well, and I think, and this is maybe, it's maybe one of the things to, as a man, I think it's important for men to bring up these issue and kind of remind ourselves that this is happening, and trying to kind of create an environment where the tolerance for that behavior disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that's kind of one of the, in the grim, I think you called it grim, was it dire, grim?
You
were describing my work and it was grim or dire. So that's part of the kind of background and kind of concern that I think I want to make sure is, because I do associate that sort of behavior chiefly with men, even though I'm sure there's times where other women have done that, but I do find, kind of think it's very strongly in my mind associated with male behavior. So,
Yeah. This is kind of changing tack a little bit,
sure.
But obviously, you know, you've been living in Canada, and yet you are, like many people in the world, painfully aware of U.S. politics, and talking about the U.K. also, talking about Brexit, kind of triggering some of this work for you. What should we know about in Canada right now? I feel like the U.S., I feel like folks in the U.S. are like woefully unaware of the rest of the world, and the world is woefully over-aware of us.
Socialized medicine's not bad.
Yeah, it's working out for you?
It's better than... Well, somebody once said that democracy, I think it was Winston Churchill, democracy is the worst system of government we have, but it's better than all the rest. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, socialized medicine is probably the worst type of medicine system you can have, but it's better than all the rest.
Mm-hmm. It's better than none.
Or hearing stories about how people have not been getting treatment. In my little time here, even hearing the kind of number of stories about that, I've been kind of shocked about how that does happen. And it just is not kind of the way I think about what happens in Canada. So Canada is not a perfect country, so do not think that you should all move to Canada. Mm-hmm. It does have, we have our problems. For instance, we still have a terrible history and kind of a need to reconcile ourselves to the way kind of the greater society has treated Indigenous people in the country. It's been very shameful, and I think it's still something that we really need to do a lot of work on to help kind of move in a better direction, so Indigenous people in Canada have some better opportunities to make a reasonable life, because there's a lot of barriers that continue to be in people's way, and a lot of difficulty of those people being a big part of full participants within Canadian society. I think that's a good example that it's not a perfect country, even though I think there's lots of positive things that I would say about Canada. It's far from perfect.
Yeah. I think people really are in a stage of glamorizing Canada because of the state of the U.S., and you're kind of in your Obama phase in a way of having like a sexy, charismatic leader.
Yeah, he's, you know...
From the perspective of, I think, a lot of people, in the U.S.
I would say that in kind of my political experience, I feel at least that, unlike some political leaders, there's sometimes where you have the feeling like I cannot in any way understand what their agenda is, you know, what motivates them. At least I do feel that, even though I have some misgivings about our prime minister, I do feel that for the most part that I understand his motivations are probably at least more positive than other political leaders I can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Even though sometimes the government behaves has its problems as well.
Yeah. Well, good. We know a little bit more than we did before. I guess I would just ask you, as we kind of start to wrap up, what's next for your practice?
Oh,
if you know, like what do you want to keep exploring in your work moving forward?
I've been kind of strange enough. I'll make it sound like, oh, I've talked about all this political stuff, and then I'm going to go with something very practical. my practical answer is I've started doing an accordion book, which is kind of a different sort of format. But it's really a book form that kind of emulates something of the mural-esque structure that my current work, or the show that's at Turin Gallery, that sort of tableau mural-like work is. I'm trying to do a book form of that, just for expediency's sake. Well, you know, because the exhibition is, you know, it's 150 components, and it's. It takes a long time to put up, and it's a big thing to store. Whereas I always imagine maybe a little book would be kind of more contained and easier to work with. So I think it's a kind of just trying to work with something a bit a different sort of mentality and kind of physicality. But even the book I've started is kind of has a lot of the same same themes. Actually, I would think there seems to be kind of a similar. Social tensions coming through in the imagery that I've already started to develop in that book. Mm-hmm. So
I can't imagine why.
Oh yeah, because things have gotten so much better mm-hmm. since I started this work. It's, yeah. The improvement is mm-hmm. leaves me speechless. Really.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard to keep it out of your content mm-hmm. creatively when it's such a barrage. So
yeah, so that's one of the things I've been doing. Yeah, I think that's kind of the
cool. And I guess what. What else would you want to leave people with? Like, what do you... sometimes I ask people for, like, a challenge for listeners or, like, something that you wish people would learn about or try in their lives.
Hmm. I probably should have a better answer for this or some answer. I feel like I've been stumped and I'm now going to just kind of talk for a few seconds uh-huh. while I let my brain, I mean, I'll just turn off that part of my brain, let mm-hmm. it kind of work over there while I'm talking through yeah. this. Because I often think, well, I'm always telling people as an educator, like, oh, you should try this and you should try mm-hmm. what you really need to do is this. And now I have a feeling like this is my big chance and I'm going, what would I tell people? And I don't really know if I have a good answer. For that, but one of the things I guess is because I think that rather than directly thinking about kind of a political engagement, I do have a feeling that there's this kind of creativity allows you to kind of give allows you to have kind of a sense of purpose and maybe a confidence that you can do things where you can kind of take something that didn't exist. Transform it or bring it into kind of existence. I think that does allows people kind of to feel that they can have kind of a social positive impact on the world. So I think I would encourage people to try something first off creative and then use that kind of experience of creativity to kind of come to social realities and social experience and kind of social practicing kind of our common sociality in the world with a bit more of a creativity and kind of a understanding that things can change and things can be more positive as opposed to we always have to kind of just be satisfied with the world as it seems to have arrived to us. Does that make sense? Yeah,
yeah.
I think that, I'll say that.
No, that's great. Yeah. Sorry, I'm always like throwing that at people at the end. Like, what's your call to action?
I guess I should have, if I had done my research, I would have listened to one of your podcasts.
No. I didn't give you much notice. So if people want to learn more about your work or follow your work, where can they find you on the internet?
Well, I do have a website. So mm-hmm. it's richardsmolinskyoneword.com.
Okay.
And it's last name Smolinski.
Cool.
So I only point that out because the most common misspelling is putting a Y at the end of my name for some reason. Hmm. And I think that would make me Richard Smith's guy.
Yeah.
But I'm ski. Think of it, downhill skiing.
Okay.
Kind of like the quality of this interview, going downhill all the time from the beginning. There, I started with such promise and then...
No.
No, it's been fun.
You closed strong.
I close yeah. strong.
Yeah. And I will put that link on the notes of
great.
The podcast, which yeah. people can find either by going to kyrs.org and going to the show page Praxis, or by going directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO, if you missed any part of the beginning of the show and want to listen back. So thanks so much again for joining me.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. This has been great.
On a Sunday morning, yeah. And you can go see the show for the rest of the month.
Yeah, see the show.
Great.
It's. I'd like to say it's fun, but I don't know. That might be misleading.
Yeah. Depends on your idea of fun.
Yeah. You've tried to take it with a sense of humor.
Yeah. Great.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. We're back in the studio today. If you're just joining us at the end of the hour, that was the last part of an interview I taped yesterday with Richard Smolinski. He's a visual artist working out of Toronto, Ontario, and visiting Spokane. Has a show up at the Terrain Gallery, as we said at the end there, through the end of the month. So you can find all those links on the show page at kyrs.org. And that's about all I've got. I do have one other announcement that is exciting. On the topic of art, the arts, etc., I don't get to feature many artists on this show, and I always am interested in doing so, especially if their work has a political bent, explicitly or implicitly or through their practice or anything like that, because we can't, you know, change anything unless we're inspired to do so and unless we use the ways that creativity can help us open up our minds and imagine new possibilities and all of those good things. And on that note, here in Spokane, Washington, our dear poet laureate, Mark Anderson, has instituted something really cool, I think, and tonight is the inaugural night. Every city council meeting from now on will be opened with a poem from a local poet. So that's just really nice in a lot of ways. Bringing literary work and creative and the abstract into what can be kind of a dour space. No offense to the city council, but it can be dry, to say the least. It can be kind of a drag, and it can be very bureaucratic and dehumanizing. It can also be entertaining. You know, I'm not trying to discourage you from going, but if you do go down to the city council meeting tonight at 6 p.m., at City Hall, you will hear the inaugural poetry performance there. So I thought in that spirit, I would end the show with a poem as well. So this is an older one, but from one of my favorite political social poets, Adrienne Rich, from 1995. What kind of times are these? There's a place between two stands of trees where the grass grows uphill and the old revolutionary road breaks off into shadows near a meeting house abandoned by the persecuted who disappeared into those shadows. I've walked there, picking mushrooms at the edge of dread, but don't be fooled. This isn't a Russian poem. This is not somewhere else, but here, our country moving closer to its own truth and dread, its own ways of making people disappear. I won't tell you where the place is, the dark mesh of the woods meeting the unmarked strip of light, ghost-ridden crossroads, leaf-mold paradise. I already know who wants to buy it, sell it, make it disappear. And I won't tell you where it is, so why do I tell you anything? Because you still listen. Because in times like these, to have you listen at all, it's necessary to talk about trees. All right. Again, if you missed any part of the show, you can find the podcast later tonight at soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. I will be back next week with a live show talking with one of my favorite guests of all time, one of my favorite Spokaneites, Sandy Williams, editor of the Black Lens News. So come back for that, and we'll see you next week.